this meeting of the House Resources Committee. We'll now come to order. It is now 1:38 p.m., Monday, February 23rd, 2026, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Colomb, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Prox, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dybert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. We were just joined by Representative Elam. Please take this time to silence your cell phone for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today in House Resources, we're hearing an update from the Alaska Mining Association, and then we will hear public testimony on House Bill 271 from Representative Fields relating to the royalties in the kitchen lights unit of the Cook Inlet before considering amendments and seeking the will of the committee. I'd like to invite Deantha Skinsky, Executive Director of the Alaska Mining Association, as well as Dave Larimer with Contango Ore and Mike Satry with Hecla Mining Company. Please put yourself on record and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, as members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. We are kicking off Mining Week in Juneau, and you're providing us this opportunity to start the week is a real pleasure. I'm very grateful. I'm Deantha Skabinski. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. We are the state trade association that represents all aspects of the mining industry, from large-scale operations and projects, our state's one coal mine, our placer mining industry, industrial mining, and then the contractors that support our sites with goods and services.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us this afternoon. My name is Mike Satry. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for Hecla Mining Company. Hecla is a 135-year-old American company based in North Idaho. Our biggest and best asset is the Greens Creek Mine right here in Juneau, where we mine silver, lead, zinc, gold, and copper in a national monument.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having us today. Dave Larimer with Contango Ore. I'm the Vice President of Exploration for Contango Ore. We are an exploration company that is headquartered in Fairbanks, Alaska. And on my copious free time, I'm also the President of the Board for the Alaska Miners Association. We're happy to be here today and kind of give you our vision. I would like to start out briefly with a quick safety share, if I may. Safety is pretty much our number one pillar in this industry, and I just want to take a quick moment to recognize that safety is personal in our industry. A lot of our meetings that we have every day, our tailgates, our pre-shift meetings, we reflect on the day and we ask our employees of why do you want to go home and why are you going to work safe and healthy today? So for me, I'm working safe and healthy today because I want to go home to my wife. I want to be able to experience Alaska for the long term out there, and I keep those memories dear to me while I'm working to the day so I can go home and have those. So thank you very much. Oh, I also want to put out there, many of you have been to our mines and many of the tours out there. You see the PPE that's given out on these tours. Please take those home with you next time you go on a meeting, because safety doesn't just stop at the mine site. It's at home as well. So please take that PPE with you. Use those safety glasses at home, because safety doesn't stop at the work site. It's 24 hours a day. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, Deantha Skabinski, Alaska Miners Association. So what we're here today is to discuss is not simply the state of the industry. Alaska mining is really entering a structural paradigm shift. It's driven a lot by state and federal permitting reform, by national strategic demand for minerals, and evolving development models that better utilize our existing infrastructure. And it couldn't come at a more important time, as Alaska's at a critical juncture for economic growth. So today, we'll walk through what has changed, why it matters to the state, and what alignment looks like going forward. So we'll give an overview. We will give a state of the mining industry. We'll tell you why we think this moment represents a paradigm shift. We'll discuss the last year of significant federal regulatory policy changes. We'll share in depth the FAST 41 process and what it is and what it isn't. And we'll discuss what Alaska can and should do now to fully capitalize it. And we'll share a long-term vision for mining in Alaska. So to start, I'm actually sharing a map from our 2024 annual report, and there's a reason for that. This displays the current large-scale operating mines in Alaska and some projects that are in exploration and or permitting. The seven operations on here are no question economic anchors of the region that they're located in. In many cases, they are the largest payer of local government revenues. In many cases, they're the largest private sector employer of high-wage jobs, all while maintaining a strong environmental performance and being good neighbors. Something we can't portray on this map, so if you'll indulge me for a moment, are the roughly 300 placer mines that are around our state producing gold on private, federal, and state lands. From the Haines area out to coastal southwest Alaska, throughout interior and the Canadian border, and up to Nome and above the Arctic Circle. These mines range from in size from 1 to 25 employees, but in aggregate, their impact and their economics are similar to one of the mines that I've highlighted today. So now I'd like to show you our 2026 map. And you can see this is quite a bit busier than the one I just showed. 2024 had 7 large-scale mining operations and 8 projects that we would consider in permitting or advanced exploration. 2026 shows an additional 12 active exploration sites and permitting projects and an additional operating mine. So I want to be clear, this isn't a declaration of, oh, the federal administration changed, and so all of these projects suddenly spring up. Any industry in Alaska can attest resource development does not work that way. But a few observations we can draw is that in the last 5-ish years, a number of factors surrounding the global mining chain have changed the landscape. The pandemic and the country realizing how vulnerable we are, and we can't snap our fingers and get everything we need right away. Geopolitical events, improving commodity prices, and so much more have contributed to elevating these projects to something to consider when we're looking at a long-range vision of the industry. We're looking at one of the strongest development pipelines Alaska has had in decades. And so this is where the paradigm shift really becomes tangible. So each year we contract with the McKinley Research Group to perform a study of our industry's economic and community benefits. They collect data from the mining companies themselves and departments of natural resources, labor, revenue, and so on to collect data on mining jobs, wages, revenues to governments, money spent with Alaska businesses, and so on. So on the screen, you can see some really great benefits outlined. 12,400 total industry jobs attributed to the industry's activity with an average annual wage of $122,000. Mine workers live in over 85 Alaska communities, and a lot of these are in rural areas where there's limited other employment opportunity. Last year, mining paid $92 million in state revenue, $47 million to local governments, and $240 million to Alaska Native corporations, bringing the ANCSA revenues to $3.6 billion since 1989. It's harder to quantify, but mining also supports infrastructure utilization and planning, private capital inflows, and a number of other shared benefits that go across our economic sectors. We have provided the full McKinley report with a lot more data in your committee packet. Thank you, Calvin and Sarah, for your assistance with that. That will show the bigger picture that we kind of got a little more brief into today. But the key takeaway from this economic information is mining is scalable, private sector growth that bodes very well for our state's future. Also in your packet is a handout on the regulatory regime at Alaska's mines. Discussing our environmental performance and mining regulation could take a committee meeting on its own, but to summarize, the permitting process does not guarantee a yes. It is a back-and-forth process in which a project proponent goes to the regulatory agencies with its conception and has back-and-forth conversation, which ultimately results in a permit application that goes throughout the public that is a product of the agencies and the project proponent perfecting the proposal. So because you see it in the public realm for the first time, that is not the first time that the company and agencies have talked about the proposed plan and made tweaks and adjustments to it to make it more satisfactory. The permitting process, at the end of the process, a large mine will have dozens of federal, state, and local permits in hand. And once permitted, the regulation doesn't just end there. There's strict oversight throughout the entire life of the mine. There's financial assurance held by the state of Alaska in the event a mine cannot perform reclamation and cleanup. And a reclamation plan has to be approved by the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources before the mine is allowed to begin operations. And the plan and the financial assurance are reviewed every 5 years to be sure that the plan is still appropriate and reasonable. There have been some significant reclamation achievements that I'd like to quickly highlight. They're on the screen here. The Grant Mine in Interior Alaska has recently had its tailings facility fully reclaimed and accepted by the regulatory agencies. Yusubeli's Poker Flats Mine achieved Phase 3 bond release, meaning it has gone through all three phases of backfilling, regrading, revegetation, and established land restoration. And the True North Mine, operated by Fort Knox in the interior, was the first large metal mine in Alaska to be fully reclaimed and signed off by the state. So it's nice to have these more modern examples of when reclamation was completed. So suffice it to say, Alaska's permitting process is stringent. We operate under some of the most rigorous environmental standards in the world. And the final plug for what's in your committee packet, if you'll bear with me, is our AMA State Issues of Concern document, which reinforces defending and promoting our incredible permitting process. So the question is not whether we regulate, it's whether we regulate with predictability and capacity. And we'll talk about that a little more in a minute. So I've laid out the important benefits in the environmental record of mines here in our state. As the U.S. looks at the concept of increased domestic mineral production, for us, mined in America means mined in Alaska. I'm going to turn it over to Mike in a moment here to discuss the federal regulatory shift, but I'd like to leave you with a few things to keep in mind. First, we've all been inundated with the term critical minerals. There is disagreement amongst the definition and how it's applied to decision making, when at the end of the day, all minerals go into important applications for defense, for grid modernization and stability, infrastructure, basically all of the things we need. All of the minerals that go into them are critical, meaning we need them and they are strategic assets to society. In many cases, the critical minerals term was used to identify the less commonly produced minerals that we are heavily reliant on foreign and sometimes adverse nations to get. And these minerals are often not produced viably on their own, but come when mining copper, zinc, gold, silver, etc. But thankfully, there's awareness of this, and federal policy now prioritizes domestic production incentives to be applied to all minerals and not just those on a specific critical list. So as a result, we produce system critical minerals across the board. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to Mike.
For the record, Mike Satry with Hecla Mining Company.
Yes, happy to. Apologies.
So there has been an amazing shift in the mining industry and in the United States over the past few years. And that really started during the COVID era, post-COVID, when, you know, across the board, you know, we as Americans realized that our supply chains were at risk. And even during the Biden administration, there was a great realization that our basic building blocks of society, the critical minerals that we use in our daily lives, the sources of those were no longer, for the most part, based in the United States. We were dependent on other jurisdictions, other governments, and sometimes unfriendly governments to provide those to us. And so there was a push in the Biden administration and certainly a big push in the Trump administration to strengthen our domestic capacity for producing minerals and to make sure that we could do that in an efficient way here in the United States. You know, there was a recent S&P Global study that said from discovery until production, on average, United States takes 29 years to build a mine. So from discovery of the geologic resource through development of that into permitting, construction, operation, 29 years. I think we all realize that if we are going to have domestic mineral production, we can't wait 29 years for the projects that were shown on Ms. Skibinski's map earlier in the presentation for those to come into production. In Alaska, we need more mines, and we need them soon to augment the existing mines that we do have today. So when we look at what has happened over this past year, there's been some pretty significant moves at the federal level that will hopefully – is my mic going in and out? Sounds a little bit weird here. Apologize. Mm-hmm. But there's been some pretty significant moves at the federal level that will hopefully accelerate those timelines. And that's especially important to Alaskans because so much of our land is federally managed. And even if we are on private or state lands, there tends to be a federal nexus for permitting as well. So from day one, when the Trump administration recognized Alaska's extraordinary resource potential and had the executive order to unleash that potential, and into last March, when the executive order on immediate measures to increase American mineral production was issued, you know, there's been no question that the current administration is prioritizing mineral development throughout the United States and hopefully here in Alaska. We also saw the recent decision on the Ambler Road approval, which is going to unlock a significant portion of Alaska for mineral development. We've seen deregulatory work across all the federal agencies that not only allows us to move forward, but allows energy developers, oil and gas developers, infrastructure developers to hopefully move forward in a quicker fashion. And this is really in response to the Supreme Court decisions that we've seen, whether it was Loper-Bright or Sackett decision that said, you know, that agencies cannot really act on their own to promulgate regulations. They have to do it at the direction of Congress. And if Congress wants to do certain things, they need to do that in their legislation. So agencies have been working hard to reflect those legal decisions to make sure that permitting is a pathway to operation and not a hindrance to operations going forward. Ms. Skibinski talked about the critical mineral list. It was fascinating to see the new mineral list, critical mineral list be issued this past fall, where the minerals that are now produced in Alaska, you know, silver, lead, zinc, and copper are now all on that critical mineral list. And, of course, the president has recognize that gold is a critical mineral as well in his executive orders. And really what that does is allows Alaska explorers, Alaska developers, Alaska operators to potentially access federal incentives, financial incentives to move those projects forward. And we've seen that in a variety of areas, whether that's up in the Ambler District or it's the Graphite Creek deposit. There's now multiple incentives for mining projects to move forward, and there's even more to be taken advantage of. There's billions of dollars that have been allocated towards increasing mineral production here in the United States and hopefully Alaska. But we all know that administrations come and go, and we talked about a project could take 29 years from discovery to production. So we have to make sure that we have durable reforms that allow us to progress and get these mines moving forward. And that's where Congress is incredibly important. And we've seen a bipartisan push to modify NEPA, modify the Clean Water Act, not to lower the environmental bar, but to make the process more efficient and predictable. And those pieces of legislation have passed the House, and now that conversation is in the Senate. And hopefully we can codify some of these things that have happened in the administration so that companies that are investing a dollar today have that certainty that there will be a return in 5, 10, 15, 20, and hopefully not 30 years down the road. Next slide.
Before we move on to the next slide, I believe Representative Elam had a question.
Yes, thank you. And you kind of actually started hitting on some of the question statement that I've had is that, you know, it's great to see, you know, better utilization of Alaskan resources for, you know, mineral and mining exploration. Some of the questions I guess I had was what things do we need to be considering here to make sure that we not only capture that but continue that momentum into the future?
Through the chair, Representative Elam, that's a great question. And Mr. Larimer is going to address some of those in his slides. And so I'll finish setting the stage on the federal piece, and then Mr. Larimer has some great suggestions that will help answer that question.
Thank you.
And just for the record, if you could identify yourself, you guys have similar similar type voices.
Understood. Okay. All right. So while there's a lot of things happening at the agencies and in Congress right now to move things along, one of the biggest tools that has been used, not just for the mining industry, but for projects throughout the United States, is the FAST 41 process. And I think it's something that a lot of people have been hearing about, and sometimes there's not a lot of knowledge about what exactly it is. There are some concerns that it's just a fast way to permit something. But the original act that implemented FAST 41 was actually fixing America's surface transportation. It was all about infrastructure, big federal projects, highways, bridges, etc. And so that original legislation created a permitting council that could coordinate and provide, you know, schedules and transparency to these large projects to get them moved through the process efficiently. There was a recognition that the NEPA process in particular, but permitting process was holding up projects that communities needed. As that council went to work and started to address some of these major projects, it was recognized that these improvements should be available to anybody doing large projects. So in 2021, the mining sector became an eligible sector to be covered through FAST 41. And so there's two pathways to having FAST 41 coverage. As originally envisioned to be a covered project, and it's all on the slide here, but you had to be subject to NEPA. It had to be a large project, a $200 million plus investment threshold. And then you have to apply to the permitting council to be a covered project. Now, there's ways to get around the investment threshold if all of the members of the council agree. But ultimately, if you are accepted by the council, Then they assign resources to set up a coordinated federal permitting timetable. Those timetables get issued publicly. Lead agencies are established, and they're held accountable through the council. If there are issues with schedule or agencies have issues with what each other one is doing, there's actually a dispute resolution process, and there's visibility up to the secretaries of the various agencies that are moving this forward. And so when we talk about reducing risk and getting return on capital coming to Alaska, being a covered project is incredibly desirable. And right now we have three covered mining projects here in Alaska. Now, the transparency projects is something that's a little newer, although it was originally envisioned in the FAST 41 Act. But these projects have been elevated up to the council. They're not fully covered. They don't necessarily get all of the benefits of what happens in a covered project, especially when it comes to some of the dispute resolution and lead agency accountability provisions. But ultimately, it provides a transparent schedule to the applicant and to the stakeholders and ensures that the agencies are coming together and there's visibility from leadership in D.C. that these projects will move forward. And there's the ability to move resources around to move those projects forward if resources aren't there. And that's something that we see, you know, more and more at the federal government level. And so if nothing else, what a transparency project does is elevates the importance of a project. People know they have to be held accountable to meeting that schedule, and projects move forward. And right now we've got three covered mining transparency projects in Alaska. So at Hecla, at our Greens Creek mine, we did have one of these transparency projects. We are an operating mine. We've been operating for 35 years and very, very successfully. We're very proud of what we do out on Admiralty Island. I think I'm not sure if we had a few of you folks out here, but we've done that in the past with the House Resources Committee. We need to get you out there again. But even though we've been operating for 35 years, exploration is absolutely critical to our future success. When I joined Greens Creek as a geologist in 1999, we had a 10-year mine life, and we still have about an 11-year mine life today because of continued exploration success. Part of that exploration is on surface. It's all helicopter-supported exploration because we are in a national monument. We can't build roads. It's very hard to do what we do, but you see one of our drill rigs up on the top of the ridge looking into Stevens Passage towards Ock Bay and Juneau right there. And what we have to do is get permits from the Forest Service to do that work. And what we try and do is get a 5-year environmental assessment done that gives us the certainty to be able to invest year after year into that exploration effort. An EA, first by regulation but now by statute, is only supposed to take 1 year. Unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, we had delays in that surface exploration project that were putting us over 2 years in moving through that environmental assessment process, which normally is a fairly simple process. When the Trump administration announced that they were looking for projects to place on the transparency list, priority projects that they could move forward, we nominated our project here in Alaska and two other projects in the lower 48, and the Forest Service put those projects on the list, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, we had a schedule. We had resources allocated, and even during the government shutdown this past fall, resources and monies were made available, and that process kept moving, and we got a final notice of decision in January, and now we have 5 years of certainty for our surface exploration project as we go forward, and hopefully we can continue to find more resources and allow the mine life to continue for decades to come. But with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Larimer to talk about their experience with FAST 41.
Well, thank you. For the record, Dave Larimer with Contango Ore. When we talked FAST 41, especially through an advanced project lens, I wanted to show this slide of this is what the dashboard looks like. We talked what the dashboard is, and this is what it looks like here on this slide. You can see on the top we've got our three projects in Alaska, but it really takes you to the next two, which was the landing page. It identifies the project, where it's at, but I really want to take your attention to that second one right there, that Gantt chart that shows it out. When we talk FAST 41 and the reform we've been looking for and what we've gotten is we talk transparency, coordination, and also accountability. You can see through this schedule that's been put up here. The project proponent works with the permitting council. We identify all the permits we need. We further go out to all the regulated agencies, how long the timelines look like, what data we need to put it in here, and we put it on a schedule. So we all know exactly what this schedule is. This is that accountability piece we talk about. But accountability is a two-way street. This is not just us as the project proponent, you know, trying to hold our regulators accountable. This is back on us as well, holding us accountable to this timeline and making sure we're meeting this so we're not slowing down the project as well. It's been a very, very good project for us at the end of the day. Under this framework, you know, these public milestones are out there public. We have parallel agency coordination at the same time, so we're not sequentially getting stopped up on each other. And it really gives that executive level oversight, you know, being able to come in on top of where we have frictions. The permitting council has actually been very refreshing. And, hey, where can we help limit your frictions? How can we move your project faster? To the point where we've actually had to tell the permitting council, nope, this is too fast. We need a little more time in here. And we agree upon these timelines. So as my colleague Mike said, Fast 41 isn't just about getting projects done fast. It's about doing them right with that accountability, transparency, coordination through here. Fast 41 and being able to move to these projects is key to the projects because it's actually a capital reinforcer. Projects would die in the permitting process as they get drug out. The capital that needs to be invested over and over again would kill projects. You know, our advanced projects in the past don't fail because of geology. We have the right geology here in the Alaska, and they fail because of schedule uncertainty, getting drug out in the financial capital and needs to sustain those long permitting timeframes. Having the Fast 41 project, being able to get those committed timelines gives us that incentive, and it also gives us that assurance that, yes, we know what we need capital-wise to get this project through fruition. For Fast 41, this also ties back to the state. You know, getting mines online, you know, just ties back to state revenue timing. You know, job creation, infrastructural utilization, and making Alaska competitive across the nation in our mineral industries. Our biggest ties in with this for the state of Alaska, we do have the Fast 41 MOU that was signed on August 25th. State agencies do have the capacity to meet the coordination timelines. That's a question that we have that we're looking at, making sure we can insulate that capacity. And we also want to avoid the state-level bottlenecks. You know, being able to nest our state permitting procedures with the federal procedures through this and getting them all nested up, going in the same direction, fighting in the same direction, ultimately is going to be key to our project advancement in the future through Alaska. Driver Ford. There we go. I want to shift gears briefly and talk a little bit more about our paradigm shift that we've talked about in Alaska. I do want to talk briefly about this direct shipment of ore model that Contango Ore has been talking about the past couple of years, but this really does represent a paradigm shift within our industry and in Alaska. What the direct shipment of ore is we're looking at mining projects, mining material, and instead of processing them at the site through large processing plants, utilizing the known infrastructure in Alaska and North America to transport this ore, whether it's in a truck or a sealed container, to a facility that we'll process it at the same time. What this does for us as a company, and Contango is a good example because we've showed this success through the Roman Cho project, is we can utilize the infrastructure we have in Alaska to bring these mines and these projects to fruition. What the DSO model does is without a mill, without major tailing facilities, it reduces that initial capital that's required. The majority of those mines on the previous slides we showed, those seven major mines from 2024, six of them had large processing facilities to be able to break that ore down, extract those metals, or at least to concentrate it. And they are a large footprint. The DSO model changes that in that we don't need these large facilities anymore, so we don't need as large footprints. We don't need the environmental impact that we have if we're using the infrastructure we have now. Again, this is an extremely huge tie back to Alaska. That means companies can bring these projects into fruition faster, get those royalty streams up and running. This directly ties with more projects into payroll and the economic advances of our projects. And at the end of the day, this means more advanced projects will be able to advance to mines into Alaska. We did want to highlight a couple things of what to do next. We framed the vision. We're showing what's going on out there and the vision going forward. But there are some asks of what we think we can do better and what we need help with from Alaska Miners Association. And the first one really is our agent capacity in the state of Alaska. We need to fully resource our permitting agencies, protect those technical staffing levels, and reduce those bottlenecks through the state. One of our concerns and one of the frictions we're looking at now is in the industry, we do have an aging workforce. And when I talk agency, we're not just talking the miners, but we're also talking the permitters, our regulators on the state side. We are an aging workforce. There are people that are getting ready to retire that have that technical knowledge out there, and we need to be able to protect that, insulate that, and have those succession plans so permitting doesn't slow down when our technical staff does retire. Our next one is also jurisdictional control. You know, we've highlighted before and talked about it, but we also like to highlight, you know, advancing our state's 404 primacy. You know, maintaining our defensible water authority and strengthen our state-led coordination. I mean, at the end of the day, in Alaska, we do it best because we are Alaskans and we know our state. Our process alignment is kind of the next pillar, modernizing our OPUMP tracking. OPUMP's been a great institution that's helped maneuver projects, but as we've seen from the FAST 41, how can we align our OPUMP tracking to be the same, to increase that transparency, coordination, and visibility across our state projects? And, of course, enforcing that milestone discipline through that online process. Kind of the last one is kind of new is our access and our data discipline. We need to protect our mineral access and our land use planning through the state of Alaska. Some of our recommendations are we need to look, again, at the Alaska State Geological Data Repository. For the state of Alaska, we have not been required to turn in our data. And a lot of the data that gets out there has been collected from exploration companies gets lost. You get companies that go defunct, the data gets lost out there, and it doesn't come back. So one of our recommendations is really look, how can the state of Alaska as a landowner be able to get that data back and have a central repository that we suggest where the data can be collected to help maneuver these projects in the future down? Nothing's worse, and I can attest to this from experience. I have worked on projects where on the state lands where I knew for sure a geophysical survey has been done in the past. But without access to that data, it's not brought back to the state. You know, I've dropped $80,000, $100,000 geophysical surveys to redo a physical survey that I knew in my heart was already done. As a geologist, that's painful. So we'd like to have discussions in the future of how can we best maintain our Alaska land database. As Alaskans, because at the end of the day, competitiveness is structural. It's the structural things out here. It's not just rhetoric that we talk about. And with that, I will turn it over to Deantha to bring it home for us.
Thank you again for the record, Deantha Skavinsky, Alaska Miners Association. I appreciate my co-presenters bringing their two unique perspectives of an operating mine and development projects and getting the information before you today just in where we're at as an industry. I think we can ask ourselves, and it's an exciting question, what does this look like 20 years from now? We are really at a point where we can truly see mining's benefits multiply across the state. And it wouldn't just benefit, it wouldn't just bring the mines online. It would bring significant investment, good Lord, I need to slow down, not just in the mines, but in the associated infrastructure, in other types of community development. We could start doing new things that we aren't currently doing, like processing, and we can really build a workforce that builds generational stability. Our industry is really prepared to invest the long-term capital in Alaska to make that happen. We'll continue to operate responsibly, and we're here to partner with you guys at the state and our communities. Thank you again. We'll go ahead and flip you our contact information for all three of us. And just remind you that tomorrow we'll be gathering at the Baranoff Hotel for our Juneau Mining Forum. It's our fourth annual one. Many of you have been involved in it in the past, and we appreciate your contributions to its success. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Skavinsky. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, we went through a lot without asking any questions. They're kind of piling up here on the end. So I have a couple of things, but I won't take it all in one bite. So first off, I have got my perspective as the Energy Committee co-chair, and that mining and developing new mines is something that helps grow our energy market and our demand for energy. And when you've got a larger scale, you can reduce costs. So I really appreciate that mining is a part of that here in Alaska, and would like to make sure that plans for mines are being considered as we're going through the integrated resource planning, so that there is forethought on where we're building these our generation and transmission infrastructure. Along that line of infrastructure development, I think that there's been some concerns and conflict with the Mancho in transportation, and that there's been some projects that were prioritized for making sure that that infrastructure was sufficient, that transportation infrastructure was sufficient, potentially at the cost of some other projects that were supported by communities. If there's a little bit more that you can share with us on the coordination between the mining industry and the rest of infrastructure development, I'd appreciate that.
Start up to the chair for Representative Mears. Dave Larmer, Contango War. I 100% agree with you. Part of our presentation today, and one of the things we're looking at from Alaska Miners' point of view, is what's that strategic vision? You know, it starts here now from the mining industry, from AMA, of what's this vision look like for the next couple years? And then from our subcommittees with our partners, we need to branch out, but you're absolutely right. Mining, at the end of the day, really is a function of transportation and energy, both of which we know we're very restricted with in Alaska. So from a Alaska Miners Association, we want to have this conversation now and keep developing this forward-looking framework to expand out to the rest of our committees, to nest with transportation, to nest with energy, so we know and we can plan these out in the future of where we need, because it's intertwined together for the benefit of Alaska.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Mears, Mike Satry with Hecla Mining. If I can add, you know, Mr. Larimer is absolutely correct. We do need to have that integrated resource planning, but I think you can look at some great examples of, you know, for example, what's happened here in Juneau in the mines, being the Greens Creek mine being the foundational customer for expansion of hydropower and providing even more energy to a community. There's great partnerships that can happen there, and to address some of your other points, we need to make sure that we are working in concert with the greater community needs and state needs as we do that resource planning as we go forward. We're happy to be at the table to do that.
Representative Dibert, or Co-Chair Dibert.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for being here and for your presentation. My question is, as I go out and talk to families next summer, and if they have youth that want to go into these fields, what is a few directions that I could send them if they want to go into Mr. Larimer.
To the chair, Representative Dibert, Dave Larimer, Contango. Yes, I mean, workforce development is absolutely a passion for all of us in the mining industry. I will say, to caveat, that our Alaskan workforce is a strategic leverage advantage. You know, it's not only miners, you know, pipe fitters, electricians. It's the whole entire gamut. I mean, all the way down to your accountants, your warehouse. Everyone is considered a miner or, you know, an exploration. We will have, I don't want to call it a workforce shortage, but there are a lot of competing demands coming up in the future with large-scale projects. What we're doing through Alaska Miners Association is we do partner with some other organizations, our Alaska Resource Education. We get out there, help educate kids of what the mining industry is and what it brings. And it's not just the old talking of, like, oh, geologists and engineers. You know, I say that as a geologist. It's the full gamut of what the mining industry is, to get kids excited about it. That will be our next workforce, is going to be these kids coming out there. I do recommend to these kids out there to, you know, see what their interests are in life. You know, it is about being in the outdoors. We're all outdoorsy people in the mining industry. Well, that's why we take environmental conservation so important, even in our mines. So I do applaud, getting out there talking to our kids. It's yes, we could tell the kids high-paying jobs, you can afford your Nintendos and PlayStations, but it's really about that stability and being able to have that Alaskan lifestyle going forward and contributing to your community and having a fun job at the same time.
Anyway. Madam Co-Chair Dibert, I want to just say, and I'm not being tongue-in-cheek, if you can send them my way, my members will fight over them. Any interested young individual that wants to work in our industry, we are interested in training. We have a number of great programs around the state. I'm hoping I can completely put Mike on the spot and have him discuss how a operating mine starts at a training program, recruits a student, and walks them through the training in order to have a job at the end of it. It's a great success story. And it's a little bit of a shameless plug, but tomorrow at our forum, we will have three students that went through the Mining and Petroleum Training Service that graduated and are now employed at a mine, and one student that went through the University of Alaska's mobile maintenance technician program. So you can hear it directly from their mouth. But Mike, maybe you can walk them through kind of how you guys start with the interested individual and how they end up with job placement.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mike Satry with Hecla Mining. We've recognized for years that development encouragement of a local workforce has to be a priority, and it continues to be challenging. But we invested with the University of Alaska Southeast to create a Pathways to Mining Careers program, and it starts off with a dual credit course that students can take in high school, and they show up in the evening, spend their time with us as miners, learning about all the things that are available to them in the industry. And we have mentors that come in and talk to them about what their job as an engineer is, or what their job as a water treatment plant operator, or a dozer operator, an underground miner, a surface technician. We try to run through the entire gamut of opportunities for them. And then what that allows them to do, and hopefully we've piqued that interest and got them into our program at the University of Alaska Southeast, that really tries to get people into our diesel mechanic program, because that's our greatest need. Quite frankly, our region, just all of the sectors, all of our industries need diesel mechanics. We're helping to build regional capacity as well. And we move them through that. It's a 2-year degree program, get an underground certification. And, you know, we at one time, I don't know what our current numbers are, but we had over 10% of our diesel mechanic workforce there as well. We also utilize the Delta Mine Training School that's run through the Mining Petroleum Training Service, where we'll go out and we'll recruit people here in Southeast Alaska. You know, maybe they're a commercial fisherman, or they've been working, wherever, in industrial capacity somewhere, construction. They want to get into mining, but they don't have the skills. Well, if they meet our criteria, we'll pay to send them up to the Delta Mine Training Center, and they go through that experience of living in a camp, working underground, learning to work safe, having safety as a priority value, and getting all that basic training they need, and then they come back and work for us. And that's been incredibly successful. So there's great opportunities, throughout Alaska. We've done this with the University of Alaska Southeast. We partnered with our the other mine in Juneau, the Core Alaska Kensington Mine, to do that. But there's voc tech opportunities, career tech opportunities throughout Alaska that we all need to be taking advantage of and working to promote.
Representative Mears, the representative Prox.
Thank you, through the chair. I wanted to touch on a couple of things on the slide, state position, what to do now. So on agency capacity, my first job was as a regulator, and so I'm a little in tune to those issues. I took advantage of the opportunity to do some mine tours this summer, and I always seem to find the environmental permitter that was available from the mines on the bus, and I'm like, so, hey, What are your real things? What are we getting down to? And the ability to have regulatory staff that have been around, have institutional knowledge, are familiar with the processes, are familiar with the projects themselves, is really important. And that being able to keep those personnel on board, working for the state in our case, really helps understand. I've done environmental permitting myself, and occasionally there's someone that's new to a process that can really really take some time and have some challenges. And I never worked on a project large enough to utilize OPUMP, but the folks that I talked to this summer were all very happy to have that process available to them. Offline, I'd like to talk more about jurisdictional control. I realize that's a bigger issue these days, particularly in light of Sackett. Things have gotten a little rewritten, so I'd like to have a larger conversation about that. We can do that offline. Probably a little more to get in than here. And then I would really like to explore more the access and data discipline, having information. How do you know what project to develop when you've got all this vastness of Alaska? So I'm going to forget the name now that I'm trying to think of it off the hand. The Geologic Material Data Center in North. Did I get it right? In North Anchorage, and all the core samples that we've got there, all the data that's been done over the years. I know that we've had this discussion in resources in the past about the value of the information from the exploration leases for oil and gas. And if the state had done more data processing, then that would be more beneficial. I'm guessing it's the same here on our other geological resources for mining. So definitely open to have more of that discussion, because if we've got folks that are looking at developing in Alaska and it's all just a big blank slate, or they're only familiar with small areas, it's an investment in ourselves to, you know, polish that up and say this is an economic development opportunity, rather than each project taking little bites at it. So that was a lot, but I'm super excited about this slide, possibly because there's a lot more stuff that the state has opportunity to take some action on. Thank you.
Absolutely. Representative Mears, through the chair, thank you. We will follow up very promptly on that. Excited.
Wonderful. Thank you. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I'm excited about this. I guess first thing is, would like to get together probably offline and put some time into training. It's broader than just diesel mechanics and bulldozer operators, everything from permitting to catering. And we need to make sure that we're working with the various educational institutions. The other one that I was concerned of, you know, when you say fast, 41. Ooh, golly, I don't like fast. engaging the public sooner. We had the Manh Choh project as a case in point. I was fortunate enough to get out and look at the project way ahead of time, ask some questions, and then I found out, ooh, they're gonna truck the ore. Golly, that's a new one. And my next question was to DOT, have you heard about this? Yes, they had. They'd worked out a lot of the details, and I was comfortable, so great. 6 months later, I get a call from somebody. Oh, my God, they're going to be doing the driving trucks down the road. But it was a legitimate concern when people, the public, and anyone that might be concerned, gets involved late in the game, they understandably get excited. And that's something that I think we have to work on. There's a certain amount of work that needs to be done, but at some point it's good to get this out to the public. Through that exercise, we found several things that kind of were forgotten, and it improved the project. It was difficult to go through, but it improved the project, and so I would encourage you to think about that, even if it's not required.
If I may, through the chair, Representative Prox, you know, thanks for that comment. You're absolutely right. I would like to say, through this paradigm shift, one of the lessons we have learned is as we shrink those timelines, that engagement criteria doesn't change. So from Alaska Miners' point of view and from the project proponents, that has been our lessons learned of getting out there, engage early, engage often, and keep that updating over there. Because that transparency is not just with our regulators, it's with our communities out there as well. So I just want to say thank you for that comment. It is heard.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like seeing no further questions, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for your presentation. And we look forward to future discussions and hope to see you all tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. With that, we're going to take a brief adieu before we move on to the next agenda item. All right, back on record, in-house resources. We'll now move on to our next agenda item for the day and take up House Bill 271 from Representative Fields. I will now open public testimony on House Bill 271. Is there anyone in the room or online who would like to testify? Welcome, Jeff. Please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the House Resources Committee, my name is Jeff Landfield. I run the Alaska Landmine News website. But I'm here today testifying as an Anchorage resident and NSTAR and Chugach electric ratepayer. I'm here to speak in strong opposition to House Bill 271. This bill is merely the next in line in a long line of attempted political handouts to John Hendricks, the owner of Hex Fury. I've been tracking and reporting on Mr. Hendricks' unscrupulous activities for 3 years. Mr. Hendricks does not deserve any more special treatment from the state of Alaska. Mr. Hendricks bought Fury out of bankruptcy in December 2019 at a fire sale price of $15 million, thanks in part to a $7.5 million loan from Ada. Prior to that, from July 2016 to May 2018, Mr. Hendricks served as former Governor Bill Walker's chief oil and gas tax advisor. Ask yourselves what information Mr. Hendricks learned about Fury's money problems when he was Governor Walker's oil and gas advisor, and what kind of advantage that gave him in purchasing Fury out of bankruptcy. From the start, Mr. Hendricks tried to get his property taxes reduced by 90%. His property taxes, based on an assessment from the state of Alaska, are approximately $1.6 million a year, split between the state of Alaska and the Kenai Peninsula Borough. The State Assessment Review Board, or SARB, ruled twice against Hendricks, first in May 2021, and again in May 2022. Both times they upheld the state's $81.7 million assessment, both were unanimous decisions. In June 2021, Mr. Hendricks filed a lawsuit trying to reduce his property taxes. In May 2024, an Anchorage Superior Court judge also ruled against Hendricks' attempt to massively reduce his property taxes. Mr. Hendricks attempted to put political pressure on then-Deputy Revenue Commissioner Brian Fechter for not approving his massive sought-after property tax reduction. He went as far as trying to get Brian Fechter fired from his job for not granting his demand for property tax reduction. The revenue commissioner at the time, Lucinda Mahoney, was conflicted out of that decision because her husband, Steve Mahoney, was Mr. Hendricks' tax attorney in the property tax lawsuit. When the SARB vote failed, Mr. Hendricks chose to seek a political solution. In February 2023, Senator Kathy Geisler introduced Senate Bill 50, which aimed to radically change how oil and gas property taxes are calculated in the state of Alaska. This bill was written to benefit John Hendricks. When I tried to talk to Senator Geisler about the bill, she actually referred to it as the Fury Bill. Luckily, after an article I wrote exposed what Mr. Hendricks was trying to do, the bill was withdrawn a week after it was introduced. A year later, Mr. Hendricks sought a different political solution to deal with another financial problem he perceives, overriding royalties. On February 4th, this committee heard from Mark Slaughter, Hex Fury's chief commercial officer, about these overriding royalties. Keep in mind, Mr. Hendricks was well aware of these overriding royalties when he purchased Fury out of bankruptcy in 2019. In February 2024, Senator Jesse Bjorkman introduced Senate Bill 254, which aimed to have the state forcibly acquire private overriding royalties through eminent domain. As written, the bill would have allowed the state to confiscate overriding royalties only below 68 degrees north latitude, which would apply to Cook Inlet and not the North Slope. Senator Bjorkman told me on two occasions that Mr. Hendricks did not talk to him or inspire him to introduce the bill. The week after I spoke with Senator Bjorkman, I obtained a letter from Mark Slaughter, written 2 months before Senator Bjorkman's bill was introduced, that proposed to do precisely what Senator Bjorkman's bill did. The letter was sent from Mark Slaughter to Thai Energy, owned by Houston-based geologist, geophysical interpreter Carl Mollier. Mr. Mollier holds a small overriding royalty in the kitchen lights unit for work he performed years ago. Again, after reporting I did expose what Mr. Hendricks was trying to do, Senator Bjorkman's bill failed to get a single hearing. It seems Mr. Hendricks has abandoned the Senate approach and has turned to the House. And so far, he has had better luck. House Bill 271 has already had a hearing from this committee. House Bill 271 aims to reduce the royalty rate in the kitchen lights unit, the Cook Inlet field Hendricks operates. In September 2024, Mr. Hendricks petitioned the Department of Natural Resources for royalty relief in the kitchen lights unit. After 5 months, the DNR agreed to reduce Mr. Hendricks' royalties in Cook Inlet by 75%. Again, it took DNR 5 months to agree to the royalty relief. The legislative session is only 4 months, and there are no oil and gas experts in the legislature qualified to deal with this kind of complex business matter. The DNR also agreed to backdate Mr. Hendricks' royalty relief to the time he applied, resulting in a $2 million credit for royalty payments made during the 5-month period. After the 75% reduction resulting in royalty payments declining from approximately $400,000 a month to $100,000 a month, Mr. Hendricks was put in the fortunate position of not having to make any royalty payments for approximately 20 months, unless he starts producing a lot more gas. House Bill 271 aims to make this royalty reduction permanent only in the kitchen lights unit, not anywhere else in Cook Inlet. My last point. On February 4th, this committee asked Mr. Slaughter and state officials how much Fury was charging for gas. I'm sure you all noticed that no one answered the question. I will tell you. While Hillcorp is delivering Cook Inlet gas at a contracted rate of approximately $8 per MCF, Fury is charging around $13 per MCF, even after the royalty relief Fury was given by the state. Here's the bottom line. The gas produced by Mr. Hendricks is by far the most expensive gas in Cook Inlet, not due to higher costs, but because he knows he can put a gun to the head of South Central ratepayers because they have very limited options. Thank God he only produces a small fraction of Cook Inlet gas. The royalty relief he's already obtained is nothing for ratepayers. It just enriches his pockets. Is Cook Inlet gas constraint supply constrained and concerning for South Central residents and businesses? Yes. But I can tell you one thing. Giving John Hendricks more handouts is not the answer to this problem. Anyone who has so shamelessly demonstrated the troubling kind of behavior Mr. Hendricks has does not deserve help or special treatment from the Alaska legislature or the people of Alaska who ultimately foot the bill. I urge this committee to put this bill where it belongs, in the trash. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Landfield. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to provide public testimony? Seeing none, I do see one person online. Ms. Carrie Harris, would you please state your name and your affiliation for the record and begin your testimony?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm Carrie Harris. I oppose HB 271. This bill creates a permanent 3% royalty carve-out for a single operator in the kitchen lights unit. The state is the trustee of our public resources, and it's your duty to manage them for the maximum benefit of Alaskans. Alaskans are being told there isn't enough money for a permanent fund. Essential services are strained. Everybody is tightening the belts, their belts. And now the state is talking about taxes. Yet this bill would lock in a permanent royalty discount for one operator for decades. That's money that will never go to public schools, safety, infrastructure, or dividends for Alaskans. There is nothing geographically or geologically special about the kitchen lights unit that justifies this permanent carve-out. It is not uniquely deep. It is not technically unusual. And it's really appalling that you would even consider this while talking taxes. This is conventional Cook Inlet gas. It's produced in the same basin under the same climate logistics constraints as other operators are doing. There's Beaver Creek Field, Deep Creek, Granite, Kenai Loop, the Cosmopolitan, Nikolai, and Redoubt Shoal. They all operate under the standard royalty structure without special carve-outs. Locking in a 3% royalty for this field that's not geographically or technically special, that sets a really big, bad precedent. Will the other gas producers then demand the same treatment? Will they all get 3% royalties? And how much money will the state lose when they do? And at this time, when you guys are talking taxes, you voted down PFDs. This is disgusting. And if that producer can't make money on the 12% royalty rate that all those other ones that I just listed are making money on, if he can't make money on that rate, then we can keep it in the ground as savings instead of a loss. I am against HB 271.
Thank you, Ms. Harris.
That's all.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. Let's see. Seeing no one else in the room or online, we'll now close public testimony on House Bill 271. We previously set an amendment deadline for this bill for Tuesday, February 10th at 4:30 p.m. The committee received three amendments. We do have the bill drafter, Emily Nauman, from Legislative Legal on the line and available for questions. First up, we have Amendment G1 from Representative Mears. Representative Mears.
Thank you. I move Amendment 1, otherwise numbered 34-LS1225/G.1.
Object.
Okay. Representative Mears, do you want to speak to your amendment?
Yes. So Amendment 1 sets a sunset to the bill of January 1st, 2030. I fully support natural gas exploration and development in Cook Inlet and the mechanism for royalty relief to make that happen. However, I fundamentally believe that this work should be done through DNR's thorough process rather than legislative action. I'm very open to looking at DNR's process if we need to modify their tools to make either the process or the royalty relief a better process. I believe HB 271 as is supersedes the royalty relief granted by DNR as it has no end date. And the DNR royalty modification terms has an expiration when the gross revenue target reaches $712 million for the kitchen lights unit. I've been told this is expected to be about 10 years. I chose to propose a sunset because the way I read HB 271, it eliminates the need for meeting plans of development for royalty relief. It also seems that Hex's business plans may be evolving as their original request for relief was 3% for 3 years and then a sliding scale after that. Hex is also contemplating purchase of a jackup rig and other service equipment. The timeline for considering the relief began with conversations in April 2023, and the process was complete last February, so less than 2 years. This amendment for a sunset would hold the 3% rate for just over five years of the relief, and from now provide almost 4 years for Hex to refine their business plan and apply for a modification if they feel it's necessary for their continued gas production. In my understanding of DNR's royalty relief in this bill, once the bill sunsets, the original DNR royalty relief and accountability through the plans of development return.
Thank you, Representative Mears. Is there any discussion? Representative Fields?
Thanks. I'm fine sunsetting this bill, but I don't think 4 years is enough of a runway to incentivize investment in major capital expenses such as the jackup rigs. If the date was more like 2035, I could support that and have a reasonable period of time to recoup major capital investment. I do want to note the bill extends royalty relief. The bill does not eliminate the producer's legal requirement to explore and produce under the lease. So the plan of development requirements still exist under the lease. It is not necessary to replicate those plan of development requirements for royalty relief. So I just wanted to clarify that for committee members. I'm 100% on board ensuring that there's production. I also think it's reasonable to provide a reasonable time frame for a producer to recoup major capital investment. And I hope that this producer or others are ultimately successful in acquiring a second jackup rig, because I think that would be a good thing for the inlet. Regardless of which producer ends up acquiring a jackup rig. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'm not inclined to support this amendment. The very basis of the bill is to provide some economic breathing room for the developer, the kitchen light unit operator, whoever that may be, and to foreshorten that by this degree, this short degree, I think is counterproductive to the actual intent of the bill. My understanding is that the royalty relief would extend commercial production for a couple more years. I don't know, about 10 years. And so I guess you don't know until you actually drill and find out. And there's no reliable production estimate. That's an estimate. Secondly, I'll echo the concerns of the sponsor of the bill, who said that they're not sure what the impact would be in the financing for this organization, which has expressed an inclination to look for a jackup rig. I'm not sure if they're still committed to that, whether the DNR-provided royalty relief obviated that need or not. I almost wish we had them here to ask them that question. But shortening the royalty relief period cannot help but damage the financing prospects for this company. And my goal is certainly to provide more energy for our communities along the rail belt, including my constituents, than it is to get back to trying to squeeze, to trying to extract royalty payments. So this is in some degree a response to our second public testifier, but I think this would go contrary to the spirit and impact of the bill, and I will oppose it.
Further discussion? Wrap up?
Thank you to the chair and to the committee. I'd like to point out that my intent and how I believe this mechanism works, it does not eliminate the underlying royalty relief. It only allows for the suspension of meeting the plan of development for royalty relief for till 2030. So the royalty relief continues under the terms of DNR until their stated time of. It's actually based on a dollar value of $712 million. So that still exists. It's not royalty relief only till 2030. It's just with those suspended terms for meeting the plan of development for royalty relief.
Representative Sadler, that was
with your indulgence. If you want to say, the question I had myself was, okay, so if there are two royalty reduction vehicles, one that negotiated with DNR by executive authority and one us by legislative authority, would they be continuing simultaneously? Would this bill negate the other one? And the answer I got back from DNR was, no, it would not negate that same $712, $750 million trigger would exist. And if the sunset were to take place and they had not yet, if the sunset proposed by this amendment were to take effect and HECS had not reached that $750 million threshold, then that royalty relief would continue probably without a hitch. So it's kind of a theoretical question. That's the answer I got.
Would you like final wrap up? We do also have Justin Black with the Division of Oil and Gas on the line, as well as, again, Emily Nauman. So there's a question for the drafter. Ms. Nauman, do you want to address the question?
And I can restate it.
And if Representative Mears could restate it, if that would be helpful.
For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. Yeah, that would be helpful.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Ms. Nauman. Representative Sadler and I have both stated that we believe that the underlying DNR royalty relief would remain into effect if there's a sunset on the bill. The bill would only supersede that royalty relief terms in the period in which the bill was active prior to the sunset. Hopefully, Representative Sadler, I stated that.
Fair enough.
Through the chair, to Representative Mears, yes, that's also my understanding about how this bill would function, and to the extent that that's been confirmed by DNR, that's especially helpful for my understanding as well.
Representative Seiler, does that address your...
Yeah.
Okay. We did do a wrap-up on this. Do you have further discussion on this amendment? Representative Fields, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Hall.
Yes.
Representative Mears.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Colum.
No.
Representative Elam.
No.
Co-Chair Dibert.
No.
Co-Chair Freer.
No.
Two yeas and a bunch of what?
Okay. And with
nays.
And with the vote of two yeas and seven nays, Amendment G1 is not adopted. Next up, we have Amendment G2 from Representative Mears. Representative Mears?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment Number 2, also known as 34-LS1225/G.2.
Object.
Representative Mears, would you like to explain your amendment?
Thank you to the chair and the committee. Amendment number 2 removes the intent language for the bill. I largely agree that the intent language aligns with the DNR royalty relief findings and determination, and I understand the need to clarify the need for royalty relief for a single unit. It's good practice to justify our legislative actions, particularly when their effect is narrow. However, I believe there's other avenues to accomplish the intent, and if this conflicts and the presence of the intent language in the bill conflicts with the guidance in the legislative drafting manual.
Representative Fields?
I just want to explain why there's intent language. So the Constitution, I think all members are aware, prohibits local and special legislation. The intent language is here to explain why we have a bill about one unit. And the simple answer, as we've discussed extensively about this bill, is that this unit happens to be critically important for Cook Inlet gas supply. It's a very large unit. As I think members probably recall, I introduced this bill for this unit because, unlike many other units, we have robust economic data about this unit. So I feel very comfortable making an argument that we should extend royalty relief because DNR has done the modeling and found that royalty relief is necessary for more production. And to address the point the second caller raised in public testimony, actually increases revenue for the state. So royalty relief has multiple public benefits from the kitchen lights unit. I think it is certainly worth considering the structure of royalties in other units. The simple fact is we don't have the data from those other units yet. So I don't feel like I have the information where I could say the right royalty rate is 3% or 6% or 9% or 12% for any of the other units. I wish I had that information. I would like to explore that issue more with DNR because I think we should be maximizing production from Cook Inlet. But the simple fact of the matter is we have the data on kitchen lights. We don't have the data for other units. So if members are supportive of the intent of this legislation of providing greater predictability for a producer to encourage more production, then I would say please keep the intent language because the intent language provides context for why this bill is consistent with our state constitution, which is to say this is not local and special legislation at all. This is about meeting a gas supply need for a large region of the state where we just happen to have data, more data, from within one unit. So for that reason, I have to oppose the amendment.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you. And this is not a question so much as a statement. In considering this legislation and the amendment, I had the question asked of me whether, you know, we are prohibited from passing bills to benefit an individual or a company. And I realize that this legislation is aimed at the leases, not at the lessee. So if for whatever reason, HEX, the current operator, were to abandon these leases or DNR were to take them back and to issue them to somebody else, as occasionally happens in the oil and gas business, then the same royalty reduction provisions would apply to whomever was the lessee. But these pertain to the leases and not the lessee, which gave me some comfort. And I'll defer to the maker of the sponsor of the bill as to the intent language. I sometimes have a little difficulty with intent language, but this does, as intent language does, provide a little bit of explanation and a little bit of body English as to why we're doing that. So no question.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Is there further discussion? Oh, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I support the amendment. It kind of gets to the core problem of this bill. I certainly don't have the expertise to make a finding one way or the other. That's the DNR's job. And maybe we need to consider the underlying statutes and the instructions that were given to the Department of Natural Resources. You know, we probably do. But we are, in the eyes of the public, giving special treatment for a particular company that owns a particular lease. And I don't doubt their argument. I just am not qualified to make that judgment. So I support at least taking out the intent language and not deluding the public that we know what we're doing.
Representative Fields?
Excuse me. I want to be clear, this bill is not about a particular company. This bill is about more production, more competition in the inlet. I also object to the I would say, demonization of other companies in the inlet. I support more companies and more production in the inlet. And this is about leases. It is not about a particular company. Thank you.
Representative Klum?
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair to the maker of the amendment. So I'm kind of confused. It seemed like at the beginning you said you understand why the intent language is there, but you want to eliminate it. What is the problem with the language that you're trying to get rid of?
Thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Cologne. I agree that it aligns with DNR's findings. Mm-hmm. I don't know that legislative findings necessarily align with that, particularly if we're looking at the insertion of intent language to try and protect us from a constitutional obligation. And then ultimately, our legislative drafting manual doesn't support the use of intent language. So I think there might be some good questions in there for Ms. Nauman from Ledge Legal. I don't if you have some specific ones, or else I can formulate something based on your question.
Well, no, I was just trying to figure out what the problem was with keeping it in there. You want to remove it. It sounds like you want to remove it because you don't want cover. This is if it was challenged, this would be good to have in there, and you don't want it in there for that reason.
Thank you, through the chair. I think maybe it's fortuitous that we have Ledge Legal on the line. Okay. And perhaps a question to Ms. Nauman. Mm-hmm. Ms. Nauman, are you available?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. I think the question is, if we have intent language in this bill, does this protect us from other legal or constitutional obligations?
Again, for the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Representative Mears. You're correct that our drafting manual disfavors intent language. Representative Fields is also correct that with the bill was flagged a local and special legislation issue, which I believe is challenged, I should say, out of the start. I think it's unlikely to be successful. But in cases, similar cases examining the local and special issue, the court has turned to legislative intent. And there are many ways for the legislature to set out legislative intent. Certainly, setting out legislative intent at the beginning of the bill, an uncodified section is one way. There's also letters and any other statements the legislature may choose to publish related to legislation or legislative testimony, including committee testimony or floor speeches, could all be considered legislative intent. So the legislative intent section is one way to do that. As you stated, it is disfavored in the drafting manual, but it is a method. There are other methods that could also be considered to the extent that the legislature wants to build that record.
Is there any further discussion? Would you like to wrap up?
Thank you to the chair and the committee. I'm glad that there are other methods to look at legislative intent. I think that having it in the bill fixes that pretty firmly in a way that might be contradicted as we move through the bill process through final floor arguments. I don't know the weight that this language would be given over anything else. These are certainly the DNR's findings for the approval of the royalty relief. I wasn't quite sure after the conversation today whether I would even be supporting this amendment or not based on our discussion, but now that we've had it, I do continue to support the amendment and the removal of intent language here. I think we've even had some things come up in our discussion today about the desire to have this legislation that is not captured in the intent language.
Thank you, Representative Mears. Representative Fields, do you maintain your objection?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Elam.
No.
Representative Paul.
No.
Representative Mears.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Coloma?
No.
Co-chair Dibert?
No.
Co-chair Freer?
No.
Two yeas, seven nays.
And with a vote of two yeas and seven nays, Amendment G2 is not adopted. I believe Representative Fields has withdrawn Amendment G5. So is there any further discussion on this bill before the committee?
Ma'am.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to offer a conceptual amendment, if I may. It's not substantive. It is kind of a word issue. It's on page 1, line 12 of the bill, 1225/G. It says the purpose to utility raters and ratepayers to protect jobs and to avoid reliance on imported fuels. Much as I might wish that we could entirely avoid reliance on imported fuels, I don't know if this bill would do so. So I would propose deleting the word avoid and inserting the word reduce. And would be curious to know what the sponsor might think of that.
Is there an objection, or did you?
I move conceptual amendment 1.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Representative Fields.
I support that amendment. With that, I will remove my objection.
Is there further objection? Seeing none, conceptual amendment 1 is adopted. Representative Fields.
Thanks. Given adoption of the conceptual amendment, I guess I would just ask that in the script it give permission to Ledge Legal to make technical and conforming changes if it doesn't already say that. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Briefities. All right, we are back on record in House Resources. Is there any further discussion about the underlying bill? Representative Mears?
Thank you to the chair and the committee. I think it's probably clear that I'm going to be opposing this bill moving forward. I think we have a robust process established through DNR for royalty relief. I am perfectly happy with their conclusions, with the information that they have in there, and I'm also perfectly happy with the requirement that there's some accountability for meeting plans of development to maintain the royalty relief. I'm also perfectly fine that there's a end date to it in dollar amount rather than date in there. So I don't see the need for the bill. To my satisfaction, it hasn't been articulated enough that will make a big difference in HEX being able to supply natural gas to us. I really appreciate their work, and I'm grateful that they're doing that, and we have that opportunity, but I don't think this bill helps support that. Thank you.
Representative Prox, and then Representative Sadler.
Yes, thank you. I guess I think that if this was a resolution that we're asking DNR to go back, take another look at the royalty relief, I would be all in favor of it. But I spent a lot of time, it's an interesting subject, trying to figure out whether this was justified. And really the bottom line that I concluded was I just simply do not have the expertise, whereas that responsibility falls on DNR. And if we need to change statutes, so that they have more latitude in making a decision, I think that's an appropriate discussion. But to just come to the legislature to ask to override something that the Department of Natural Resources does sets a really bad precedent. And it is too bad. There was some, well, inevitable that the testimony today does not shed good light, positive light, on somebody who is trying to increase gas supply, and I support his efforts, but this needs to be a resolution, not a bill, so therefore I'm opposed to it.
Representative Fields, are you in response to?
Representative Sadler can
okay.
go first.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, briefly, appreciate that. The necessity of having a statute versus relying on the executive action of DNR's commissioner, it took a long time to do that, and I think we've seen, we should understand that what the executive giveth, the executive can taketh away, and there is likely to be a new DNR commissioner in just a few short months, and there's not the certainty necessary to be able to rely on this for financing. Uncertainty is the enemy of fiscal certainty, and, you know, we heard in public testimony the concern that the state is giving away too much money, but the old half, would you rather have, you know, a half a loaf, 100% of half a loaf, or I'm sorry, would you rather have 50% loaf or 100% of no loaf at all? And that's the situation we are faced up against. My constituents do have a need for natural gas in the inlet. The basin is not what it was. We have someone willing to put their effort into continuing operation. And, you know, the fact that the law allows the DNR some discretion to do that means the path is clear for it to be done. And if the legislature wants to reach in and say this will happen, I think that is being practical and being considerate of the needs of our constituents back home. So I will vote to pass this bill through.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Fields?
Representative Sadler said 90% of what I was going to say. I just want to clarify for Representative Prox. This bill definitely does not override what DNR did. It actually takes DNR's decision and gives us some multi-year predictability and stability to encourage investment and production in the inlet. Again, I appreciate any producer that's going to go into the Cook Inlet and produce more gas, maximize competition, and maximize gas supply. And I think those are the public interests that I'm trying to promote with this bill, and I appreciate the committee's time in considering it, because I know you have a very busy calendar.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Clone?
Yeah, similar lines. It's my understanding that we tried to tell DNR what to do with royalty relief in the Cook Inlet, and that failed with Senator Rauscher's bill. So they went back, and DNR actually researched it and showed that if they had royalty relief, they would get more gas, and we are getting more gas. So this isn't telling anybody anything. This is not overriding DNR. This is actually supporting what DNR did. That's my understanding, correct?
Yes.
So I don't see anywhere that we're telling them what to do. We're actually just supporting what they already did. They did do the research, and they did figure it out, and it is producing more gas. So I just want a clarification on that.
Thank you, Representative Coleman. Further discussion? Seeing none, Co-Chair Dibert, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Co-Chair Freer. I move House Bill 271, Work Order 34-LS1225/G as amended from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations, and give legislative legal permission to make technical and conforming changes.
Object. Very well. Would you like to speak to your objection?
I believe, Madam Chair and the members of the committee, I do believe I laid it out. And then a note on Representative Sadler's concern about durability over administrations. We talked about this actually when DNR was in front of us under Tom Kay's resources in the 33rd, and have got confirmation since that this royalty relief is durable across administrations. It is a contract between the state and the receiver of the royalty relief. So that's not a concern that I have moving forward. That's sufficient.
Thank you, Representative Mears. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Colum.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall?
Yes.
Representative Mears?
No.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Representative Prox?
No.
Co-chair Divert?
Yes.
Co-chair Freer?
Yes.
Seven yeas, two nays.
Thank you. And with a vote of seven yeas and two nays, House Bill 271 passes from committee. Please stick around to sign the committee report after we adjourn. That completes the agenda for our House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting is Wednesday, February 25th, 2026, where the committee will hear the continuation of a production update from Hillcorp, the first half of which the committee heard on the 28th of January. The time now is 3:09 p.m. This hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned. Thank you.